Now I wonder whether William Wordsworth ever had to write shopping lists. And if he did, I wonder what they were like. I wonder if they were elegant compositions. I wonder if they had an emotional intensity to them. I wonder if they were recognisable as the works, as the work of that great romantic poet. Well, probably not. Probably William Wordsworth's shopping lists were bog-standard affairs, every bit as banal and functional as yours and mine. I suspect that the man who crafted those immortal words, "I wandered lonely as a cloud," was equally able to scribble down his weekly groceries on a piece of paper when the situation required it. And we encounter a similar kind of adaptability when we read the book of Hebrews, the writer of this epistle, this sermon in many ways, was equally adaptable, because throughout this book then, he engages in some very involved discourses. If you've read Hebrews, you'll be aware of that. Some very lengthy and detailed discourses. The one on the concept of rest in chapters 3 and 4. The one on the relationship between the Old and New Covenants in chapters 8 and 9. The one on the nature of faith in chapter 11, of course. He is very adept at weaving scriptural quotations and imaginative illustrations into these lengthy arguments. That's the kind of material which I suppose the book of Hebrews is best known for. But here suddenly, when we come to chapter 13, he changes his style altogether. It, as the NIV heading indicates, what we have here is basically a series of concluding exhortations. And in this chapter then, the writer kind of abandons those detailed theological arguments that he has dealt with throughout the book so far, and instead he kind of fires us, he bombards us with all these snappy, pithy, short directions on all kinds of everyday matters, sex and finance and submission to leaders, a whole range of different things. And over these next two Sunday evenings, tonight and next week, God willing, I would like us then to spend a little while just reflecting on this chapter, or at least the first 17 verses of it, which we read earlier on. This unusual section of Hebrews, this equivalent of William Wordsworth's shopping lists, where the writer changes his style and instead of the long, detailed, complex arguments, gives us all these quickfire instructions. Now, I'm aware that it's slightly dangerous, actually, jumping like this into the final command-driven parts of a New Testament book when we haven't studied the previous chapters. It can easily lead to a distorted view of things, a disproportionate emphasis on what we should do and on how we should live. Whereas when you read the whole of Hebrews, just as when you read the whole of Romans or when you read the whole of Ephesians, it's very obvious that the heart of Christianity isn't what we do or how we should live. The heart of Christianity is the kind of thing you encounter in chapter 2, verse 14 of this book. "Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death." The heart of Christianity is what you encounter in chapter 9, verse 28 of this book. "Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many people." The heart of Christianity is what God has done for us. The main message of the Christian religion is never what we do for God. It's never that we need to achieve this standard or that we need to put into practice this ethic. The main message of the Christian religion is accept Jesus Christ as Savior. Receive the salvation which he has effected. Rest upon the completeness of his redemptive work. And as long as you understand that then, as long as you appreciate That the heart of Christianity is what God has done for us, not what we do for God. And that what we have in chapter 13 of Hebrews here then is simply a portrait of the new life which, as those saved by the gospel of God's grace, we now live. As long as you appreciate all of that, then I think it's safe for us, despite not having looked at the previous chapters, to come for two Sunday evenings to chapter 13. So we're going to look at verses 1 to 17, but tonight then just verses 1 to 6. And I want to suggest then that in these six verses, the writer addresses three particular areas: membership, marriage, and money. Membership, marriage, and money. So first of all then, in verses 1 to 3, he addresses the issue of membership. Now, you're probably thinking that the second two headings, marriage and money, being rather obvious, they're both there in the text, they kind of leap out, I suppose, at any preacher dealing with this passage. You're probably thinking that I then have to scrape the barrel to find another word beginning with M to sum up verses 1 to 3, and that this word membership only bears a very tenuous connection, therefore, to the actual text. Well, if you are thinking that, let me defend my choice of that word. When I say membership, I'm referring then to membership of God's family. These first three verses here are setting out some practical implications of belonging to the family of God. This is a theme which clearly means a lot to the author of this book. Back in chapter 2, verse 10, you remember, he has described the gospel as God bringing many sons to glory. And later in that same passage, he has emphasized Jesus' fraternal solidarity with his people. He's not ashamed to call us brothers. And then much more recently in chapter 12, he has explained the sufferings which these Hebrew believers are presently experiencing in terms of God's paternal discipline. Verse 7 of Hebrews 12, endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. Clearly for this writer, one of the most basic Christian privileges is sonship. Relating to God as the Father of our spirits, chapter 12, verse 9. Membership, in other words, of God's family. And here, as I say, in this opening paragraph then of chapter 13, he's setting out some practical implications which flow from this foundational Christian privilege. Or more accurately, he's highlighting one implication, actually, and then furnishing it with a couple of examples. And that one implication then that he's really highlighting in these verses is brotherly love. Verse 1, keep on loving each other as brothers. When I was a child, I went one day with my mother to a farm near Bishop Auckland in County Durham in order to purchase a puppy. And we'd seen an advert then for this in the local paper, and when we got there, we told the woman there why we'd come, and she led us through to this litter of lively puppies, and having given us a little while to acquaint ourselves with them, she then asked the question, which one do you want? She didn't say, look, these puppies, they're a family, they belong together, I'm afraid if you take one you're going to have to take them all. She said, look, which one are you going to choose? And so we chose one and we paid the money and we took it home. And from that moment it became to us pretty much irrelevant that that dog had had brothers and sisters. We didn't particularly give much thought to it. We didn't go around telling people, look, we have this dog and he's called Sir Ginger and he's a Pembrokeshire Corgi and he's such and such an age and he had three brothers and he had two sisters, because he was just our pet. And the whole concept then of him having siblings had become a forgotten and inconsequential detail. And perhaps often for us as Christians, in the way in which we perceive our Christian identity, and even the way in which we perceive our sonship, the whole concept of us having siblings can can become a forgotten and inconsequential detail. It becomes all about me and God, my access to God as a son, my security before God as a son, my inheritance from God as a son. The whole business of sonship, it's something that we talk about a lot, and we're very fond of this doctrine of adoption. But it can so often become such an individualistic thing, can't it? And the writer to the Hebrews then, here in verse 1 of chapter 13, is blasting through all that. And he's reminding us, look, the implications of our sonship stretch out horizontally as well as vertically. God doesn't have millions of single children, so to speak, kind of scattered across the world, each one in his own little bubble, in his own little filial, private relationship with his Maker. No, God has a family of siblings, all intimately related, all bound to love one another accordingly. That's a striking thought, isn't it, for us this evening? Do you think about that much? That God cannot be your father without every single born-again person in the world, including the wackiest and the most embarrassing and the most exasperating, because of course that's never us, is it? Including all of them, every single one is a sibling of yours and of mine. That's what the writer is bringing out here in chapter 13. He's saying, having dealt with this concept of sonship in what we might consider more normal ways throughout the book, he's now bringing us down to earth and saying, remember this practical implication of it. If you're a son of God, if you're a child of God, then you're a sibling of every other child of God in the world. So, as I say, that then is the one implication of sonship that he's really wanting to ram home. But he does furnish it with these two examples. The first one is in verse 2. Do not forget to entertain strangers. Now, this direction was probably more directly relevant in some ways in that first century context, partly because there was so much pioneer mission going on of that largely unevangelized first century world, and partly because there was so much persecution going on, there were probably a lot more nomadic Christians around then than there are in our society today. Christians who were travelling from place to place. Some of them travelling then because they were taking the gospel to new areas. Others travelling because they were fleeing for refuge from persecution. This was then a very established and recognized aspect of first century Christian life, that people travelled from place to place. If you read 3 John, then you see there an example of this and references to this concept. And the writer is using this as an example then of this practical implication. He's saying, look, when strangers come to you, Christians from another place, who perhaps because they're taking the gospel somewhere else now, perhaps because they're being persecuted and they're fleeing, but they're coming to your town, they're coming to your church, then entertain them and take them in and look after them and extend hospitality to them. They're your siblings. You might not have ever met them before, you might not have ever heard of them before, but they're your siblings. That is what he's saying. Now, as I say, it's probably more relevant to that first century context, but it's still, of course, relevant on occasions now. I can think of a couple of times when I've been accommodated, when hospitality has been given to me by Christians that I didn't know. Think of a time when Hannah and I were living in Scotland and we were passing through Northumberland one time, and we went to the church in Longhorsley, and Noel and Margaret Todd, whom some of you may know, we got chatting to them, and we never met them before, and they asked us what we were doing that night, and we were basically going to go and look for B&B or something, and they gave us a bed for the night, or a time when I was in the Isle of Lewis with a friend, and again a Christian lady never met before took us in for the night. And notice that fascinating little reference in the second half of the verse, but for by so doing some people have entertained angels without knowing it. It's presumably a reference to Abraham and the way in which he then had those visitors, and he prepared food for them, not knowing at that point that these were angelic visitors. And I don't think it's saying that this is always going to be the case, that when you entertain strangers that they will be angels. It's probably not even saying that often that will be the case. It may never be the case, but I think it probably is pointing to the general principle that you can expect to be blessed and surprised by blessing in so doing, that it doesn't actually turn into a chore, that it isn't actually a burden, but you find yourself being refreshed in all kinds of surprising ways, being enriched in all kinds of surprising ways. I think of a friend of mine in Northern Ireland, and when he was a child, his parents were missionaries. They were in Nigeria before he was born, and then they came back to Northern Ireland. His father became the General Secretary of Mission Africa, the missionary society that the Garlands represent. And because of that role that his father had, they had missionaries to stay very often. And in fact, my friend says that his teacher at school must have thought that his family were cannibals, because you keep going in and say, "We had another missionary for tea last night." And as he looks back now, my friend, now that he's a little bit older than me, he doesn't see those days as being difficult days, when he was sidelined as a child because his parents were entertaining these missionaries all the time. That's how some might have looked on at it. But no, he looks back with great fondness. They were enriching days. They expanded his horizons. And indeed, he himself has a great passion for mission today because of that childhood. And I'm saying then that there's blessing for us when we follow through this instruction and we extend hospitality to Christian brothers and sisters whom perhaps we didn't previously know. So that's one example. Then the other example is in verse 3, remember those in prison as if you were their fellow prisoners, and those who are ill-treated as if you yourselves were suffering. And what is he saying? Why does he say remember them as if you yourself were in that situation? Well, the point is that it should be a big deal for you that there are Christians elsewhere who are suffering, being imprisoned or being ill-treated in other undefined ways. It should be a big deal to you, just as it would be if it were you yourself. Then it would be a big deal to your rights. And it should be that big a deal even when it's someone else, because these people are your brothers and sisters. And of course, for us, our brothers and sisters who are suffering are largely a lot further away from us geographically than the brothers and sisters of these Hebrews who were suffering. It was probably some in their own fellowship, actually, or in other fellowships nearby. For us, it's brothers and sisters in Eritrea and North Korea and so on. But surely the principle does still apply. And this is why, of course, we make the persecuted church a regular prayer point on Sundays and on Wednesdays and in the monthly missionary prayer meeting. Because we're trying to get ourselves into this frame of mind that's been described here, whereby it's a big deal to us. It's not just this intellectual awareness, oh yes, there are Christians suffering elsewhere, but it's this big deal, because these are brothers and sisters in Christ. So membership, then, is the first area the writer is addressing. Membership of God's family. This practical implication of it, brotherly love, and these two examples that he gives us. The second area he addresses is marriage, then, verse 4. Marriage, he says, first of all, should be honoured by all. Now, no doubt the writer desires that literally all should honour marriage. All in society should honour the estate of marriage. But he's probably particularly thinking of all Christians, all that he's writing to, all in the church. Marriage should be honoured by all Christians, especially. Now, it's important that he says marriage should be honoured. He doesn't say marriage should be entered into by all Christians. And that kind of impression is sometimes given in Christian circles, but of course you only need to read 1 Corinthians 7, Paul's writing there, to understand that not all Christians are called to marriage, and Paul talks there at great length about singleness and so on. And this writer here isn't saying that marriage should be entered into by all, but he is saying that marriage should be honoured by all, that all Christians, whether married or unmarried, should have a high view of marriage. And that was no doubt very challenging in that first century society. You only have to read a bit of history. In fact, you don't even really need to read history. You only have to read the New Testament itself, an epistle like 1 Corinthians, to get a sense of the social climate in which Christians were operating when it comes to sexual ethics. Marriage in many parts of that first century society wasn't honoured. And it was very, very challenging and very countercultural, therefore, for Christians to honour marriage. And of course, it's increasingly so for us, isn't it? That we live in a society where marriage isn't regarded all that highly. It isn't treated as a very serious thing. It's treated as something you can easily get into and easily get out of. And for us too, then, it's very challenging that marriage should be honoured. And I think we perhaps need to think about the applications of this. And I suppose it applies to popular culture, doesn't it? And the kind of films, for instance, that we think of as our favourite films, perhaps, and that we enjoy watching. Do those films present a high view of marriage? The kind of TV programmes that we watch regularly, do they present a high view of marriage? Or do they contribute to our society's demeaning of marriage? And if they do, then can we really enjoy those films and TV programmes while being faithful to this text? What about the people, the social figures that we admire, the celebrities in the realm of music or fashion or wherever it might be, and those whose lives perhaps are full of a disdain for marriage? Should we have a great admiration for those people? Should they be our heroes? Should we put those people on a pedestal who perhaps go through marriages like most people go through clothes? Or should not our heroes be those people who perhaps never get recognised by society, but those people who have been married for decades, have been faithful through all kinds of difficulties and trials? Those couples perhaps where one spouse is now unrecognisable from who he or she was when they got married because of Alzheimer's disease or because of some other affliction, and yet they're still together. The healthy spouse, in sickness as well as in health, looking after that partner. Surely those are the people we should honour. Those are the people we should look up to if we're being faithful to this text, honouring marriage in a society where marriage is largely dishonoured. And then he gets more specific, doesn't he? And he says the marriage bed should be kept pure. And here then he's talking about sexual purity and the matter of adultery. And when he says then that the marriage bed should be kept pure, he's saying that you should make sure that you do all in your power to keep your own marriage bed pure, and of course to keep other people's marriage beds pure, that you don't either betray your own spouse or wreck somebody else's marriage. And of course, keeping this kind of teaching doesn't begin at the marriage bed, does it? It begins with our thoughts. It begins with our hearts. It begins with how we use our eyes and what we look at and what we are occupied with. Think of David. It didn't begin at the marriage bed. It began with him taking that walk and allowing his eyes to wander. And notice too that although I said in my introduction that the writer here is changing his style and he's giving lots of kind of separate instructions, notice too that there probably is a logical connection between the first paragraph, verses 1 to 3, and what he's coming on to now in verse 4. Because, of course, keeping the seventh commandment and not committing adultery is actually a form of exercising brotherly love, isn't it? Or to put it the other way around, committing adultery is a way of being selfish and a way of striking against brothers and sisters. Paul brings this out very clearly in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, and he's talking in that chapter about sexual purity. And he says in verse 3 of 1 Thessalonians 4, it is God's will that you should be sanctified, that you should avoid sexual immorality, that each of you should learn to control his own body in a way that is holy and honorable, not in passionate lust like the heathen who do not know God. And then verse 6, and that in this matter no one should wrong his brother or take advantage of him. So he's talking about sexual morality, and he's saying that in this matter of sexual morality, no one should wrong his brother. And that probably is the connection and why he goes on from brotherly love to this matter of sexual purity. Because committing adultery isn't just an offence to God directly, is it? But it always involves ruining other people's lives as well. And then notice that final note of verse 4. God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. Now, the writer here isn't forgetting all that he has said in the previous chapters about the blood of Christ and the wonderful reality of forgiveness. He isn't saying that if a Christian does commit adultery, is sexually immoral, then that's it, then that Christian is going to face damnation at the last day. But he's saying that sin unrepented of, that sin treated lightly and allowed to continue, then that will lead a person, whether or not they are a professing Christian, to face God as an angry judge on that day. And really then he's just bringing out that God hates adultery. God hates sexual immorality. It is, of course, so contrary, isn't it, to God's whole nature. God is a faithful God. God is a God who commits himself to his people, and nothing will ever cause him to renege upon that commitment. God is absolutely steadfast and undeviating in his commitments, in his promises. He keeps his word absolutely. And God then takes seriously when men and women make promises and then break them. And that really is the point then that the writer is bringing out here. And so, how does this one find us then this evening? Are we honouring marriage? Do we have a high view of it in a society that doesn't? Is that reflected in what we watch, in what we read, in the people that we admire? Are we doing all we can to keep our own marriages and other people's marriages pure, free from adultery? And are we clear on this, that God is a faithful God who hates infidelity? Membership, marriage. Thirdly and finally, money. This is what the writer comes on to then in verses 5 and 6. And again, possibly the same logic is running through into verses 5 and 6 now. The logic then of brotherly love. Because loving money, just like committing adultery, is another way in which actually we harm our brothers and sisters. Again, it isn't just a personal, private sin that's kind of contained privately, but it's a sin which damages others. When we become obsessed with money, then we become selfish and we become loveless toward other people. I suppose that's possibly why within the Decalogue itself, within the Ten Commandments, the seventh commandment is followed by the eighth commandment. And there is that natural progression then from adultery to theft, from the importance of marital fidelity to the importance of keeping possessions in a right perspective. And It's important to notice, of course, that he says keep your lives free from the love of money. He doesn't say keep your lives free from money. He isn't saying that it's wrong for a Christian to have money, that a Christian should just chuck away every penny that he has because money is inherently evil. Of course, money isn't inherently evil. He's saying that it's not money that's the problem. It's our attitude to money. It's the love of money. It's money having too high a place in our affections. Money being too dear to us. Money being a preoccupation. Something that drives us. Something that makes us tick. Something which gets us out of bed in the morning. Something which essentially is a god in our life. He's saying that's the problem. It's the love of money. And you'll notice then that he accompanies this instruction with two Old Testament quotations. This writer, as I mentioned in my introduction, has woven into his whole book so many Old Testament quotations, many of them obvious ones. These two here are a little more obscure. Let's just look at them each in turn and why he's using them. First of all, then, verse 5, he says, keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. What's the logic there? Well, the logic is, I think, that you can be content, even if you have very little money. Why? Because you have something greater than all the money in the world. You have God. And God's commitment, I will never leave you or forsake you. And having millions of pounds in the bank could never possibly remotely compare to that. You have God, the God of glory, the God of splendor, the God of beauty. He is yours. He has committed himself to you in covenant bond so that you can legitimately, without a hint of blasphemy, say that God is my God and you're not demeaning him. And you're not saying something that's questionable. No, you can say that kind of thing. You have God. You can be content even if you don't have half of what other people around you have. Even if you don't have half of what the adverts say you should have. You've got God. You've got him. What else do you need? That is the point of that first quotation. And then the second quotation, verse 6, so we say with confidence, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid, what can man do to me? And I think the emphasis there is on that last question, what can man do to me? And the background is probably what we read in chapter 10 and verse 34. Where the writer refers to a particular form of suffering these Hebrew believers had experienced. They had experienced the confiscation of their property. And no doubt then, for some of these Hebrew believers, this was a really dread prospect. This was something that they feared, that they were going to have the authorities come and knock on their door and take away their things and confiscate their property. And the point that the writer's making here is, look, if God is your real possession, if God is the possession that really matters to you, then nobody can take that away from you. Nobody can really rob you. No one can really confiscate your possessions if God is your possession. Yes, they can take your furniture. Yes, they can take your house. Yes, they can take your money. But they can't take your God. They can't rob you of him. And if he's your prized possession, if he's your treasured possession, then really the most powerful and cruel authorities are impotent and toothless in what they can do to you. And so as we close then, what about this area of money? Again, it's counter-cultural, isn't it, this instruction that he's giving here. We live in a society that is obsessed with money. And it's such a temptation for us to get caught up in that. Do you have a right perspective toward money tonight? Thankful for it, for what money you've got. Keen to use it wisely, but not loving it. Not so having your mood tied to it that when you're not earning what you'd like to earn, you're sad. And earning more money makes you happy. But having God as your great possession, God as the object of your dearest desires. And perhaps tonight you're not a Christian at all. And perhaps tonight money is really the thing that you live for. And I just want to address you and challenge you that money is this very vulnerable thing that the writer's touching upon here. It can be confiscated. It can be taken away. You can lose it just like that. In fact, you will. Whether or not you lose it in this life, you will lose it all at death. It's a rubbish thing to lean upon. It's a rubbish thing to make the great prop, the great crutch of your life. Remember in Isaiah chapter 40, the writer there, Isaiah, talks about idols and gods, and he's using very sarcastic language. In verse 20, he talks about a man too poor to present an offering, selects wood that will not rot. He looks for a skilled craftsman to set up an idol that will not topple. And I think the writer is writing this tongue-in-cheek, this ridiculous concept of having to set up a god that hopefully won't topple. And the inherent paradox of that, a god that might topple. And if money is your god, if that's what you're living for, that could very, very easily topple. One day it will topple. And there's only one god that won't topple. And that's Jesus Christ. And if you come and take refuge in him, give your life to him, and live the rest of your days for him, he'll never fail you. And no economic meltdown, no recession will make any dents in Jesus Christ. He's a sturdy, robust God that you can lean the weight of your eternal soul upon. Don't live for money. Don't live for career. Don't live for economic success. Live for Jesus Christ. May God help us all. Amen.